The year is drawing to a close and 2018 is just around the corner. So what's the forecast for Hawaii's economy? Congress overhauls the tax code, so what's ahead for island residents for the short and long term? Visitor numbers continue to climb, but so does the price of housing. Our red-hot construction streak may have peaked, but how much of a slowdown will we see in the new year? And what about wages and interest rates? The experts weigh in today.
We're asking our listeners to join in the conversation by calling us at 941-3689 on Oahu or 1-877-941-3689 on Neighbor Islands. Joining me and Catherine in our studio are Carl Bonham, Executive Director and founding member of UHERO, the Economic Research Organization at the University of Hawaii, and Louis Salaveria, Director of the State of Hawaii Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism.
Again, those numbers are 941-3689 on Oahu or 1-877-941-3689 on Neighbor Islands.
Carl, I'm going to quote your report right back to you at the beginning of your this is a report released, what, December 15th, just last week.
Last Friday, yeah.
This is the economic forecast for Hawaii. Improving global conditions provide a favorable environment for continued expansion in the islands. Visitor arrivals are surging to record highs. Unemployment is reaching new lows. The expansion is now well into its eighth year. All indications are the growth will continue, if at a more subdued pace. That's the overview, right?
That's it in a nutshell, right? We're continued expansion, but it has to continue to slow down. If you've got unemployment rate at 2.2%, there's not a whole lot more room for significant job growth. And we were talking before the show about shrinking population. There's just expansions run their course, and while you rarely know when it actually is going to end, you can get the general direction of slowing growth.
Well, just if I just read that paragraph, it's a pretty rosy outlook, right?
It's a lot different than the way it used to be, say, for example, in the 80s and the 90s. I mean, our growth rate now has been at that 2% rate. We don't see the kind of growth rate that we used to see with the 5%, the 6% spikes. It's the new norm. It's what we're dealing with right now. And our numbers and UHERO's numbers and Carl's, they're fairly consistent. We see continued expansion going forward, but at a slower pace.
But actually more like 1% than 2%. And actually, in this expansion, we've seen very few years where we had the 4% and 5% growth rates. And for something like total real income or total real GDP, we're really looking at numbers. I mean, 1.5% is probably the best we can hope for. If you're talking about population growth down in the 0.5% to maybe 1% on a good year, your total growth of the economy is just the sum of how fast your population grows and how fast your productivity grows. And so if population's growing at sub 1%, getting up to that 2% growth is pretty challenging.
What are you predicting for state spending, with the Council of Revenues?
So the Council on Revenues doesn't predict spending, right? So they predict tax revenues, and actually they're meeting in about 2 weeks to give their updated forecast. And actually, I'll be on an airplane during that meeting, and I predict it's going to be a very interesting meeting because of the tax changes in Washington and increased uncertainty. But the revenue growth for this fiscal year so far, it seems to me like it's been coming in about between 4% and 5%. I don't recall the exact number.
Mm-hmm. That's an area that I have a little bit of experience, having been with the Department of Budget and Finance before this particular gig. We continue to see government spending increase, but primarily for addressing issues such as our unfunded liabilities, our long-term pension costs, long-term health care. All of these things are bills that are coming due right now. So the idea is that we are increasing spending, but it's where the spending is going that seems to be what is really driving government spending going forward.
Yeah, if you look at government employment, it's essentially flat for the last several years. So we're not growing the size of government by that metric. But you know, as Lewis pointed out, one thing that is growing is contributions to pensions and to the unfunded liabilities.
You did mention the tax overhaul. Congress just voted. What's ahead?
Well, the most immediate thing that's ahead is that the typical taxpayer in the country will see a better paycheck, after-tax paycheck, in February. The average taxpayer in Hawaii will see some tax relief. About 7% of Hawaii households will actually see an increase in taxes. It's about roughly 50,000, 60,000 taxpayers will likely see an increase in taxes. But over 500,000 of them will see a decrease initially. The challenge really comes longer term, where by the end of this process in 2025, 26, 27, there's a couple hundred thousand Hawaii taxpayers who will see a tax increase. And most of those are taxpayers at the middle income and below. So essentially, you get a little bit of relief now, and then you pay up going forward. Of course, Hawaii corporations are going to see a tax cut. And a lot of the debate around this tax bill and about its economic effects comes from a debate about how those corporate tax cuts will work their way through into the economy. And the broad consensus amongst academic economists and the economists who do this for a living at the Joint Center for Taxation and the Congressional Budget Office and the Penn Wharton Budget Model and IHS Global Insights is that these corporate tax rates are going to have extremely small effects on overall economic growth.
Similar to what Carl is talking about, we do see a degree of short-term relief, but then there are some long-term answers that nobody knows what's going to happen. If these tax cuts come into play, well, they're expected to come into play, is that what does that do to the federal deficit? And what is that going to do to states that have to maintain certain costs for just continuing operations? It's just the shifting of the tax burden away from the federal side down to the state side. And so that's one of the things that we're seeing. And what we're worried about is that what are the states going to have to pick up the pace if the federal deficit does increase?
So the deficit will increase.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we're talking about an increase in – so the number you keep hearing is $1.5 trillion. That doesn't count the interest payments on those increased deficits. And from those same groups of people that I mentioned before, those same organizations, we're getting estimates of an increase in debt of between $1.5 and $2.2 trillion. So the question is, does that then lead the federal government to reduce spending, right, which then is picked up by state governments? And that's an uncertainty that is worrisome.
We're hearing a number of references to a shift in balance between federal and state government, Lewis. We both alluded to some form of that, but we don't really know what form that's going to take yet. It's also what it sounds like.
There are some things that are clearly defined in the shifting between the federal and state government, and a lot of that has to deal with how the federal government is going to be treating tax-exempt bonds, for example, going forward for issues like affordable housing. One of the things that they've been looking at, and you know, I'm happy to say that it's off the table right now, but they are looking at the way states get tax-exempt bonds financed at the state level. One of the things that is in the version of the tax overhaul bill right now is actually taking away advance refundings for states in using tax-exempt bonds. So that takes away an ability for a state to refinance its own debt at a lower cost because the federal government is no longer going to provide the tax-exempt status for those things. So it is, that's an absolute shift into the states.
So the other thing is that the limiting the deductibility of state income taxes essentially means that every dollar of state income taxes that, not quite every dollar, but if a dollar of state income taxes now costs Hawaii taxpayers more than it used to cost. Particularly for those in the upper middle income and higher who are going to be impacted most by that limited deductibility. So if you were paying $15,000 in state income taxes last year, all of that was deductible on your federal taxes. Mm-hmm. In 2018, only $10,000 of it will be deductible. And so that last $5,000 is now costing costing us more. So that puts a burden on the state. It makes it more difficult for the state to raise revenues in the form of income taxes.
There was a concern about nonprofits feeling the squeeze, if people aren't going to be, you know, itemizing deductions, maybe make them reluctant to donate as generously as they did in the past.
I mean, that's people definitely are affected by incentives, right? And so with the larger standard deduction, there will be some change in the number of people who are itemizing. I don't recall the exact number, but actually the number of people who itemize is not all that large to start with. Some of those charitable deductions were already capped based on income. So I think there will be some effect. I'm not sure it's going to be exceedingly large.
Carl, you referred to 50,000 people in Hawaii who are going to be affected, whose taxes will go up under the new tax code. Which 50,000? I mean, at what?
So income? Actually, I think the number is closer to 60,000, and that the source of that is the Institute for Tax and Economic Policy. So they do state by state. They run models for every single state in the country and look at the implications of tax bills by income, and it's going to be people at every income level.
Oh, really? It's not at specific income level.
Yes. Based on what, though? Well, good question. So, you know, you can take two different people or two different families with exactly the same income, and one earns it one way, the other earns it another way. So let's say you've got two teachers. They're both earning labor income being paid by Department of Education, State of Hawaii, and let's say they make $100,000, and then you take a realtor who is maybe set up as an LLC, and maybe they're earning pass through income, and they could have totally different tax bills. That's not a great example because the income level is not super high, and that's where the pass through helps the most.
Well, but who would pay more?
Presumably, the teachers were. Yeah. People who are earning labor income as opposed to income off of assets,
yes,
or income as a pass through business. Or income as a stockholder in a corporation, if you're earning non-labor income, you're going to be better off.
Mm-hmm. That seems to affect one, aimed at a different class of society almost.
Well, by far the biggest beneficiaries in this bill are the top 5%, even the top 1%. Mm-hmm. And so if you look at the average tax cut for the middle of the income distribution, it's about $1,000. And the tax cuts that you're talking about at the top 1% are orders of magnitude larger than that.
What about wages? Because we have so many people who work two jobs just to try to pay the bills.
Well, so the average worker in Hawaii is going to see a tax cut. And mm-hmm. they won't see the same kind of benefits as someone who's, you know, has three apartments and is renting them out and in a completely different tax situation. But so on all told, and these numbers are for 2019, the estimate is that taxes for Hawaii households, corporations, everything will go down by about $1.3 billion in 2019. So as Lewis pointed out, that's going to benefit our economy. It's not going to cause the unemployment rate to go down to 1% and grow jobs by 5% or anything like that. It's going to be a small – and then there's also the effects on the rest of the taxpayers in the country. Our economy may benefit from the big tax cuts that the top 5% of the income distribution in the rest of the country are getting. In other words, they may come here and spend more on their vacation, or they may come here and – look at buying additional real estate. There's a whole variety of different ways that we can be affected.
If you're just joining us, we're conducting a panel on Hawaii's economic future and recent economic projections. Our guests in the studio are UHERO economist Carl Bonham, State Business Director Lewis Salaveria. If you've got a question to pose, please call us at 941-3689 or 1-877-941-3689. Anyway, I had to get that in,
sure,
so we can get some people to join us on this.
Sure.
But there are lots of it really looks as if the effects of the tax cut that you were just describing aren't consistent across the board. It's sort of hard to tell how you're going to be affected.
It's very much about redistributing the pie.
Yeah.
I mean, the pie, the slices of the pie are getting much bigger if you're well above the middle of the income distribution. The slices of the pie for the rest of us are pretty small.
If you look at the tax brackets, right, the seven tax brackets that exist under the federal system, you know, where are the tax cuts happening, right? The 37 is going down to at the one end of the spectrum, you have the people who are paying 37. They're going to go down to like 35 or 34. Sorry, I don't have the exact numbers. But then on the other end of the spectrum, the people who are paying 10% stay at 10%. So where, I mean, literally, where is the tax cut happening? So, yeah. So
we spoke earlier, I think it was last week, we spoke with a man named Brink Lindsey, co-author of The Captured Economy. Here's what he says. It's kind of on point to what we're talking about.
Economists have formulated a big trade-off between efficiency on the one hand and equality on the other. So often measures that are designed to grow the pie faster, make the slices of pie more unequal, and those measures that that work to equalize the slices of pie may slow the rate at which the pie grows.
Well, so I don't disagree with that. That's definitely true. The problem is, does this grow the pie? And most of the, I would say all of the credible analysis says it grows the pie very little. So we're talking about maybe increasing total gross domestic product for the United States out in 2027 by maybe 1%. So over 10 years, so we're talking about adding maybe 0.1% to growth every year.
That's
now, do you want to do that? So that's what he was talking about in the efficiency. This is going to grow the economy more. So the question is, one question is, are we going to grow the economy very much? And I would argue no. The Republicans would argue yes, that we're going to get this enormous growth, which we've never seen after a major tax cut. You look at the growth rates of the U.S. economy after the Reagan tax cuts, after the Kennedy tax cuts, after Bush tax cuts, you don't get a surge in growth. So what you're doing is you're redistributing, you're moving around the deck chairs, and mostly benefiting the very high end of the income distribution in exchange for raising the debt. And when we're going into a period of history where we're going to, where the U.S. is going to face increasing costs of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, healthcare costs, and we already have a sizable debt, so it strikes me as poor choices that really don't benefit the average person. That's for sure.
What about the concern that folks might have about a recession?
A national recession?
Yeah.
Well, it's going to happen.
We're due,
I mean,
right?
Winter is coming.
Yeah.
It's something that you do have to plan for. We don't we don't know when that's going to happen. That's part of the issue of why you don't want to be raising deficits now. When the economy is near full employment and it's humming on all cylinders, that's when you should be paying down your debt so that when you go into the next recession and your unemployment payouts start going up, your natural costs start rising, you have the ability to inject some additional money into the economy. So when the next recession comes and our deficits have been going up every year, will the federal government on the fiscal side step up and do anything about the next recession? I don't think so.
And policymakers, decision makers, elected officials, or people in government finance are always looking at when the next recession is going to happen, because we do understand that it is going to happen. It's the natural economic cycle. The question is always going to be is how low is that trough going to be and how high is that peak going to be? Because that volatility, for government people, I mean, that's it drives us crazy. It really does.
Sure.
So that's the thing. And exactly what Carl said is that if you're going to be running up the deficit, in the future that that's going to happen, what other types of expenditure cuts are you going to have to make in order to pay off that debt, right? The federal government has the ability to print money, unfortunately, unlike the state of Hawaii, which can't. So again, what do you do? You start to mess with all these different things. You mess with the interest rate. You know, you mess with our currency valuation. You start doing all of these different things when you start looking at the long-term implications of this type of spending pattern.
So the story that I've been telling for over a year now about one way the next recession could happen is it's actually would be related to the increased demand that gets created because of these tax cuts. So if the Federal Reserve just raised rates, mm-hmm. so we're now at a 1.25 to 1.5 on the Fed funds rate, which is still fairly accommodative monetary policy, but they're on a path to get us to 2.25 by the end of next year. And the reason that they're doing that is that they believe that we are at full employment. In other words, they believe that a 4.1% unemployment rate is essentially full employment. When demand goes up, okay, when people are out buying more goods and services, that creates demand for workers. And what it's supposed to do is drive up wages and drive up inflation. And the Fed is kind of sticking to that view of the world. So if you just dump a whole bunch of extra money in the form of a tax cut and people go out and spend it, okay, that should cause prices to go up. It should cause inflation. And what's the Fed's job? It's to take away the punch bowl right when the party gets going. So the problem is sometimes they spill the punch, right? They have to move the punch bowl off the table gradually, right? If they yank it too hard, they spill the punch and you have the next recession.
Okay, on that note, I think we have a caller from the Big Island that wants to join in on the party here. We have a call from Puna, Jamie. You have a question.
My question, I heard the argument that because people have stocks and companies, the massive corporate tax break benefits not only the corporations, but they're the real beneficiaries as being stockholders. Does this talking point wash with your expertise?
That's exactly right. If you want to know why the stock market is up 18% so far this year, yeah. It's because of the expectation that we were going to get this tax cut.
It was already baked in.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, you really, and actually, I don't know where the market went today, but you shouldn't have seen much of a movement in the market today that was because of the tax cut, because they already knew it was going to happen. Mm-hmm. And so basically the value of a stock is just it's just adding up the future flows of dividends that you receive off of the corporate payouts. So if the taxes for that corporation goes down, then their after-tax ability to pay dividends has just gone up, and they only have two choices. They either sit on the cash or they pay out the dividends. I mean, they can reinvest in the corporation. And to the either one of those drives up the value of the company, which shows up in the stocks, which then flows through to the stockholders.
Pregnant silence there.
Yeah.
Some of this sounds as if it's an unsustainable course, that expenses are rising. We're accumulating debt. Debt gets more, both on federal and state level. You know, does this have to pop at some point? I mean, the intersection of debt and revenue, where does this all go?
That's the Soylent Green argument, I think, on some cases. I think the issue of the debt and the debts going forward, how are we going to start addressing issues like pension payments, right? How are we going to start addressing issues like healthcare payments? I think what policymakers need to do is to try to bend that cost curve going forward. That's one of the things that they can do, right? You know, get people healthier, right? Make people feel like they don't have to go to the doctor, that they can take care of themselves, and treat illness at a lower level as opposed to it getting acute would be one example,
right,
of trying to address these long-term liabilities so that states can get lower premium payments and they can help address some of these things. So it's not just a throw money at the problem and it will go away. It's going to take a concerted effort of different types of strategies in order to address it. And one of that is, you know, it's the double-sided coin, right? You know, you have expenses, but you also have revenue. If we don't have the revenue, let's try to drive expenses down in order to meet those obligations in the future. So to say that it's unsustainable, it's only unsustainable if you're not, if you don't try to address it and if you don't look at it in the, you know, in the side of the room. So
yeah, if you don't do anything.
Yeah. If you don't what?
If you don't do anything, right?
Yeah.
You can always change course.
Yeah.
And
how hard do you think the state is going to try to increase revenue? You know, they have been looking at trying to collect the taxes on the vacation rentals. What do you think we're going to see going forward?
So there's two types of revenue. There's new revenue, like if you were to add a new form of tax, or then there's revenue enhancement. You're taking something that you're supposed to be collecting revenue on but haven't for whatever odd reasons. You know, the issue associated with alternative vacation rental units really is one of, are we collecting something that we're supposed to be collecting anyway? And, you know, that's something that I think it just makes common sense. It's compliance, really. So we just want to make sure that we're compliant. And if that adds revenue to the state's coffers, which it should have been there in the first place, then that money can be used to address a lot of the public service expenses that are coming up in other areas.
But do you think there's a will there to really start collecting, because we've been talking about it for...
Well, we were talking about this. You know, oftentimes it takes a couple of years for a bill to actually make it through the legislature. 3 years, right? It's the first year, just everybody's like, what is this? And then the next year, it's like, okay, I kind of know. And then the third year is when they say, okay, well, we have to do something about it. And, you know, we're in the third year now, actually. So, you know, a couple of things are happening. 2018 is a very important year. We hope to see, you know, some parity and some compliance happen in an area where compliance should be happening anyway.
Right. I mean, it's an election year.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Nobody wants to make unpopular.
So we saw increases in tax rates last year. So the top end of the income tax distribution went up. I don't recall the exact rates. Basically, we went back to the rates that we had during the Great Recession. So there was a period of time where the top income tax bracket was higher. And I don't want to throw out a number because I don't know the exact number. And then those rates came down after the recession, several years after the recession. They were raised in order to try and raise additional revenue when the state's economy was down. And then the top bracket was reinstated in the last session. And some of that money was allocated to earned income tax credit. And so that's intended to help the lowest earners in Hawaii. Unfortunately, that earned income tax credit is not refundable, which means that if you don't earn enough to actually pay income taxes, you can't get any of it back. So my guess is we won't see any significant efforts in the next session to raise rates in any particular way. We also saw changes in the TAT and other things around rail. My hunch is that we're done raising rates for a little while. But the
compliance.
Yeah, compliance is a big deal, and the tax department and has been working on some of these things for quite a while. Whether it's collecting from the online travel wholesalers, Expedia, and others, and we're now collecting from them, and we're also without any, I don't think anything that we necessarily did, but we're now collecting from Amazon. So Amazon is collecting and remitting taxes on the things that they sell.
We have a caller on the line with a question, a comment about corporate tax rates. Steve from Volcano, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Okay. In the past, we had heard about the corporations not really paying that high tax because they had so many loopholes and deductions. And a good example was Exxon, who made billions and billions of dollars and didn't pay a penny tax. So now that we have a lower tax rate, are there any, did they do anything about the loopholes and deductions? And if not, then what's even the difference?
That's a really good question.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's part of the reason that the people who are running the models to estimate the impacts of these things, this is part of the reason that they're not finding much impact, is because the effective, so the estimates of average effective tax rate for corporations, by that I mean the average tax rate that they're actually paying after all the deductions and other loopholes, was about 22 or 23%. So if you go from an average effective of 22 or 23 to an actual of 21, and that would assume that you got rid of all these other loopholes, you really haven't done much, right? I can't tell you unequivocally that they got rid of all the loopholes.
Yeah.
I know that there are still. I did read about the what's it called? I want to say covered interest. That's not the right term. But this is where people who work for hedge funds or others on Wall Street are able to pay a lower tax rate on their earnings because of the way they're paid out. So not all the loopholes are gone. I think that's safe to say.
And Steve, I mean, right, when you have a corporation and you have, you know, a litany of people that are there to help you work your taxes, you yeah. obviously are able to find the most advantageous. That is not the same for the average person. So, you know, these loopholes are going to exist. They're going to come up. They're going to show up in some different form in some way because they just have that level of resources. So with the corporate tax breaks that are happening right now, the question is, we always go back, is that money going to come back into the economy? And that's the question that we're all waiting to see.
Again, if you are just joining us, our guests in the studio are UHERO economist Carl Bonham and State Business Director Luis Oliveira. How's your economic outlook for 2018? Let us hear from you. Call us at 941-3689 or 1-877-841-3689.
Carl and Luis, I'm going back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago. It seems as if many of the assumptions on which the new tax code are based on some theories, economic theories that you've more or less discredited. As you were saying, economic growth does not follow tax cuts. There's a long record of it not happening. So why do it, I guess, is my overarching
question. Well, the people who wrote the legislation have a strong belief that cutting taxes is going to change the world. And
belief's one thing, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's what it's based on.
On faith.
Well, and a desire to redistribute the income. I mean, that's what this is about. It's they're redistributing the pie.
From whom to whom?
Well, by 2027, from almost all families who are earning labor income to corporations. Now, they would also argue that
corporations will employ people. They'll do all
well,
of these
they
things.
Well, they will. But they would also argue that those tax increases that are going to happen late in the next decade won't actually happen because we're going to extend them, right? So we're not going to let those tax increases happen. But they had to let them happen in the bill because if they didn't, the deficits would have gone up indefinitely, and then they couldn't have passed the bill with a simple majority. They would have had to have had Democratic support. So, you know, there's a lot of there's a lot of this is just made up in order to satisfy constituents who are the top earners and the top donors. And it's going to be fascinating to see what actually happens, right? I mean, I'm talking about research and models and analysis that's been done for years. There's some uncertainty there, right? It's not it's not perfect, but we have an experiment, unfortunately.
Well,
and we're going to get to watch and see what happens.
You're talking about a process that flies in the face of that research, though.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's been pretty heated debate going on in the op-ed pages of the Wall Street Journal and other places between what I would call the mainstream of economics. Larry Summers, in particular, has been a very heated critic of Mnuchin and others who are making, you know, the Treasury Department came out with a quote-unquote study, a report, I think is what they called it, mm-hmm. to show that this was going to pay for itself. It was two pages of claims that then Larry Summers critiqued and said, you can't even, you know, you're cherry-picking numbers to even support your ideology, right? There's no research there. And we're probably getting too deep in the weeds. That's why we're not getting any phone calls.
Someone tried to, or I forgot. I mean, it might have been Robert Reich that was talking about it once, and he tried to explain where, you know, when you try to inject money back into the economy, money is only good if it keeps on circulating and it keeps on moving. People go out and spend it.
Right.
But if you're giving money back to people who probably have money already, what more are they going to buy? What more is that going to create in going to the store? You know, can you buy another car if you already have three, versus a person who has one car or is catching the bus and now has the ability to buy a car, right? So it's where that money is going to start moving within the economy and who would make a better play of putting it back in.
What's the forecast for our housing situation? Because you just drive around anywhere, you see the homeless being shuffled from one place to another. You know, government saying, "Well, we can't build affordable housing fast enough."
We still see a continued growth of the median price of homes. Until we get to a state where we can start putting in the level of supply that needs to come in and addressing issues between density versus going out into, you know, urban sprawl. These things, I think there's a statistic out there, or there's some data out there that shows the level of home growth right now is the lowest it's been since, like, World War II. So we're not putting enough supply into the market right there to basically address these issues. So demand continues increasing. What's happening right now is that old home that should be cheaper is just continuing to get more and more expensive because there's no supply. So, you know, I think from a government perspective, what we're trying to do is to make it easier for people who would invest in affordable housing construction to get them to the point where they can continue to just, you know, start pumping supply. Obviously, easier said than done. We're continuing to work with the affordable housing development community. But, you know, these projects take years to bake. And oftentimes, a lot of them are dependent upon federal low-income housing tax credits, too, as well. So given the uncertainty that's happening over there and all of these things, you know, there's a lot of things that create a lot of uncertainty within the affordable housing market.
So there's a number of things that you mentioned, and you referred to homeless and affordable housing. And you know, the word affordable means different things to different people. And part of that homeless problem won't be solved no matter how many houses we build, right? Some of it just needs flat-out shelter and needs programs to help people avoid becoming homeless in the first place. And there are efforts that are ongoing. By our estimate, the median home price on Oahu will be close to $800,000 for 2018. That'll be the sort of median for the year. And we're really not – so most people don't believe this, but home prices haven't gone up that much. if you look relative to our historical experiences – now, $800,000 is a heck of a lot of money no matter how much it, you know, it went up. But if you look at an historical experience, so like the last, we call it the subprime bubble, right, where home prices peaked in 2007, over the course of that housing cycle from the bottom, which probably would have been late 90s to 2007, home prices doubled. If you went back and looked at the Japanese bubble period, right, where prices peaked in, say, 90, 91, mm-hmm. home prices went up 130-140% from the trough in the early 80s to the peak. Home prices have only gone up 30% in this cycle. I mean, we were at about $550,000 for the median on Oahu back in 2009, I think, was the bottom. And we're at about $750,000 today.
Chris made an interesting point. We were chatting the other day, and we saw this week Hawaiian Air make an offer for the assets of Island Air, and it was $750,000.
Yeah. Right. Last week you could have bought an airline for less than the cost of a home.
But if you compare the cost of a home to median household income, okay, so if you take the cost of a home divided by median household income, it's about maybe eight times median household income right now, 7.5 to 8. Back in the peak in 2007, it was more between 9 and 10. So home prices aren't as expensive today on Oahu relative to how much money we earn in the middle of the income distribution as they were back in 07. And in real dollars, they're barely higher than they were at the peak of the Japanese bubble.
So, and that's the affordability.
So the point is that things haven't changed that much. And getting back to Lewis's point, we simply don't produce enough housing units on this island. In 2016, not just this island, but statewide, in 2016, I think we permitted around 4,000 housing units statewide. Okay, the trough during the 2009 to 2015 period was a little over 3,000 housing units. And by our estimates, and probably similar to what DBED has calculated, if we produced 4,000 or 5,000 units a year, we'd barely be keeping up with population growth. Mm-hmm. And wouldn't do anything to reduce the backlog of not enough housing. Not even close. We need to produce more like 7,000, 8,000 housing units for a decade every year to close the gap and actually produce enough supply that will really constrain price growth.
And we're nowhere near that.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely not.
Yeah. Here's a caller with a comment on the housing market. This is Brian from Honolulu on line two. Brian, can you hear you?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Tell me what's on your mind.
I just had a quick comment. You never hear about the fact that the military, there's a lot of single military in the state, and they're getting really substantial several thousand dollar allowances to go out and compete in the rental market. And I was wondering, what you're doing with state housing.
That's got to be a sizable impact, doesn't it, Brian?
Well, suppose that the state would somehow or other come up with a plan to raise teacher salaries by $1,000 a month. We wouldn't say, oh, gosh, that's going to drive up rents. I mean, this is part of their income. I mean, and if you look at the typical single enlisted personnel, their income is not very high. It's certainly at the entry levels of enlisted personnel. Sure. They're not making what a new school teacher makes. This is really part of their income.
And, I'm not so much concerned about the income issue versus they're a competitor for a rental unit. Obviously these
are. So are you.
Yeah. Yeah. They're added in, but also there's the military that, are they producing enough, on base housing, for
housing
example.
Of their own,
right?
Yeah.
Versus telling the soldier that, here's some money, go look for, housing outside. I agree with Carl. I don't necessarily think that drives up prices per se. But what it does do is just creates a tighter market because you have more people there because they're not providing.
I have to add that, with all this talk about monster houses, there was that one home or apartment or whatever you want to call it on Hoftailing with 29 bedrooms. And the neighbors were telling me, they're renting it out to military people. It's not an extended family. And when I was there, I saw military personnel walk in and out. I don't know for sure if they live there, but again, it's competition for units, but it's that whole, what do you do? People see it as a moneymaker to be able to have more units to survive in our economy, and yet there's the tight rental market.
So in a nutshell, you have more people who are making more money, and you're not building enough housing, okay, then that's going to drive up rents and it's going to drive up home prices. And it doesn't really matter if it's a private or if it's a bunch of 25-year-olds who moved here from the mainland to work in the tourism industry for a couple of years and enjoy life in Hawaii, right? If they're here and they've got them, now they might be living 10 to a house, but they're still impacting the demand for rental units in the state. And the problem is not doing enough development. And if you don't build new housing that is available for everyone, right, at all different levels. So let's say, there's no construction in Kaka'ako. And so you know, 65 or 70 year old who lives in a excuse me, a 60 year old house in Palolo, who wants to get out of that house because it's too much maintenance. They've got nowhere to go if we haven't built the condos, right? They may have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars in equity, and they could move into a new condo and retire in it. But if you didn't build it, they can't do that. And that's the cheapest affordable housing you can have, is the 60-year-old home with the jalousie windows that won't close and you know, the pipes that will barely let any water through. That's cheap affordable housing. Building brand-new affordable housing is as expensive as it gets. And most of the affordable housing, the vast majority of it, is not new housing. It's old housing. Mm-hmm. Excuse me.
We keep running into that term affordable housing, and the way you describe it, Carl, it's almost a contradiction in terms.
Carl said it. The most expensive form of affordable housing is brand new.
Brand new, which makes a lot of sense. And yet the need continues, the need grows.
Yes.
Well, that word unsustainable keeps rocketing through my brain. Why does that happen?
Well, unsustainable assumes that you're not going to come up with solutions later at some point in time. You know, I think whether it's private sector, innovation that's happening, all of these different things, you know, the idea that there are going to be solutions for problems that exist right now is kind of part of the whole process of addressing it. You create the problem, and then you're going to find somebody who's going to find the solution for it.
Well, let's take affordable housing. For 30 years plus, we've been hearing we've got to do something about affordable housing. Mm-hmm. So that search for solutions remains in the future, right?
Well, yes.
Yes, and part of it, right, you know, you look at this, creating more density within the urban core, right? Granted, there are, some high-rise units that probably are priced out of the average person here in the state of Hawaii, but then there are some units that are starting to come up, right? If you can create more, more density within the urban core, create that supply, then, you start kind of chipping away at that, at that backlog of units that gets, and right, it's a lot easier or faster to build a high rise with 300 units than it is to build 300, single family homes.
So this is an area that UHERO is particularly interested in, and we were fortunate enough to receive a generous donation from the Hawaii Community Reinvestment Corporation to establish an endowed professorship in affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
We're recruiting for that position right now. And the goal is to bring to bear research and knowledge on what works and what doesn't work from around the world, and to try to help inform policymakers and be engaged in the conversation long term. Because there's no short-term solution here.
Right.
And in my experience, what over 20 plus years at UHERO, what you observe is that when home prices are on their way up and it's getting harder for people to come up with down payments and so on, there's a lot of discussion about affordable housing, and there's a lot of discussion about housing. And then when the next recession hits and
strange silence.
And home prices start falling, right?
Yeah.
Okay, and maybe they go down for 3 or 4 years. There's no discussion, and so you need the topic needs to be front and center with policymakers forever, and it needs to be about how do we produce more housing, mm-hmm. and there's so many different issues from NIMBYism to
land use.
I mean, land use is crucial.
Mm-hmm.
It, by some estimates, by the Wharton School, has an indicator of regulatory burden in housing markets, and Oahu is at the top of that list. And if you think about how long it took for two housing developments that are recently broken ground, Koa Ridge and Ho'opili, I mean, you're talking decades to get a project off the ground.
You really have to think in long terms for that, and that's tough for the public to do.
Well, when you're talking about working on a project, investing in a project for decades, you are significantly driving up the cost of that housing.
Mm-hmm. Gentlemen, we are coming to the end of our time period. Catherine and I both thank you for being with us, and we have to apologize to a couple of callers. We haven't had time to pick up their calls, but it's clear this is a pretty robust subject. Any final thoughts, Lewis?
I mean, we went all over the place here, from tax policy
that's,
to
that's
housing,
what we do.
To, you know, vacation rental units. I think, you know, for us and what we're seeing at the state level is we're in the eighth year of a six-year economic cycle. Basically. So, you know, we're continuing to grow. This is like uncharted territory for us. You know, what we expected to happen didn't happen, and we're continuing to move forward in this, you know, lower growth kind of trajectory.
Right.
And we expect that to go, you know, all the way up until 2020, for example, where we see some contraction starting to happen. And for that, I think we need to be prepared with just slow growth. Nothing is going to be extravagant where you're going to see some astronomical number.
And we probably have to say that we hope that we don't have a war or some infectious disease outbreak somewhere in the world that's going to impact us in a way we haven't planned for.
Yes.
Carl, I figure we've got about 30 seconds left.
Merry Christmas.
I couldn't have thought of a better way to sum this up. Thanks to everyone for taking part. We'd like to thank our guests, Carl Bonham of UHERO and Lewis Salaveria, Director of the State of Hawaii Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism.
If you didn't make it on air during today's discussion, you can still call our talkback line and leave comments. We'll play those comments later this week. That number, 808-792-8217. You can also send us an email at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
And if you want to listen back to today's show, check out the Conversation podcast at hawaiipublicradio.org. Tomorrow we'll discuss the state of rental housing in the state and across the country, continue the conversation about sexual harassment in the visitor industry. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us more for more of The Conversation.